This week's episode of Undisclosed is brought to you by three great sponsors. Longtime friend of the show, Stamps.com, is back. ABC's newest drama, Conviction, also supports us this week. And finally, our most delicious sponsor, Blue Apron. Make sure you listen in for the spots later in the show, and be sure to support our sponsors because they support us. Until then, enjoy the program.
Even after months of investigation, digging, and dangling reward money for information, Stanley Sutton found himself unable to make a case strong enough to bring actual charges against Joey, until he found the perfect witness. Hi and welcome to episode 15 of Undisclosed, The State versus Joey Watkins. My name is Rabia Chaudhary. I'm an attorney and a fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace. And as always, I'm joined with my colleagues, Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
I'm Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney with the Volkov Law Group, and I blog at viewfromll2.com.
I'm Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
The origin of the adage, with friends like these, who needs enemies, is uncertain, but many trace it back to the Bible. In the book of Job, God tells Satan that there is no one on earth as good and faithful as Job is. He worships me and is careful not to do anything evil. Satan responds by asking, would Job worship you if he got nothing out of it? Suppose you take away everything he has, he will curse you to your face. God then replies, all right, everything he has is in your power, but you must not hurt Job himself. Satan then arranges to have Job's children killed and his wealth destroyed. Thereafter, Job's three friends arrive with the best of intentions, seeking to ease Job's pain, but they end up making matters worse by making certain assumptions from the available evidence. One friend asks, think now, who that was innocent ever perished? Or where were the upright cut off? As I have seen, those who plow iniquity and sow trouble reap the same. And according to a second friend, God will not reject a blameless person and not take the hand of evildoers. In modern parlance, when someone says, with friends like these, who needs enemies, they're referring to someone that they believe to be a friend, but who turned out to be a frenemy acting in bad faith. But if the book of Job is the origin of this expression, it more comfortably applies to an actual friend who tries to help, but ends up hurting. There's even a term that people sometimes use in this situation, Job's comforter, a person who in trying to help says something that simply adds to the distress. In this case, Joey had his own version of a Job's comforter, Josh Flemister.
Stanley Sutton came onto the case on February 28, 2000, already committed to the belief that Joey Watkins was responsible for the death of Isaac Dawkins. He spent the next 10 months interviewing hundreds of people, subpoenaing thousands of pages of records, wiretapping phone lines, and wiring up witnesses, searching for some kind of evidence of Joey's guilt that was solid enough to make a case against him. But Sutton came up short. On November 9th, Stanley Sutton had a meeting with Agent James Garman of the Georgia Bureau of Investigations, who had been brought in to assist with Joey's case. The Georgia Bureau of Investigations gets involved in local investigations when they're requested to by law enforcement. So Agent Garman's notes from this conversation state, investigator Stanley Sutton of the Floyd County Police stated himself and members of the City of Rome Police Department are pursuing Watkins as a suspect, but no evidence has been obtained to lead to an arrest. But 4 days after this memo was written, Joey Watkins and Mark Free were arrested for the murder of Isaac Dawkins. So what could have changed between November 9th and November 13th that transformed a stalled investigation into a closed case? What evidence did the Floyd County Police Department find in those 4 days that made all the difference?
You swear that what you're telling me, you were in that truck that night, sitting in the middle, not at either side of the windows. Did you ever fire a gun at Isaac Dawkins?
No.
Did Joey Watkins fire a gun at Isaac Dawkins?
Yeah.
And you saw the wreck and you heard the shooting. And Mark Free has sat in jail and told several different people that he was there. Was Mark Free there?
Yeah.
And what was his part in it?
Really, I don't know, because I didn't know anything was really going to happen. I didn't really think Joey would find him. I mean, I didn't know all that was going to happen.
I know. It's the truth?
Yes.
And before, you denied to me that you were in with Joey Watkins when that shooting took place, but now the truth is that you were with him, right? Speak up.
Yes.
On November 11th, three Floyd County officers, Stanley Sutton, Bill Shiflett, and Tommy Shiflett, took a road trip to the suburb of Richmond, Virginia, where Joey's friend, Josh Flemister, was working a construction job. They interrogated him in a motel room and recorded him confessing that he was with Joey and Mark, wedged in between them in the middle of the bench of Joey's truck when they hunted down Isaac Dawkins and killed him. Sutton's and the Shiflett spent the next day driving back from Richmond to Rome. The day after that, Joey and Mark were arrested. Joey has been imprisoned ever since.
Were you surprised to hear he confessed?
Yeah, to the story that he came up with the first time. Saying that he was with us when it happened. Yeah, it blew my mind. I can't believe he did that. It came out of nowhere. It was like sideline. It just blew my mind to hear him say that.
Josh falsely confessed to being an accessory to Isaac's murder. This isn't a point in dispute. Josh returned to Rome and met with the police and the DA and told them he'd made it all up. And prosecutor Tammy Colston agreed. Josh made that whole story up. It didn't happen. But, she told the jury at Joey's trial, the fact that Josh had falsely confessed is itself proof of Joey's guilt. Because Josh had falsely confessed in an effort to protect Joey, whom, she said, Josh had loved like a brother. That it was his loyalty to Joey that had caused him to falsely claim to have been part of Isaac's death and to have witnessed Mark and Joey doing the shooting. Joey has a different theory about what happened.
I've took Josh to the hospital twice because I thought he was going to die. I would actually stop by his house, and he would be on Xanaxes and taking all these pills. And I would come in, and I'd ask his dad, I'd be like, where's Josh at? He's passed out in his room. And I would go back there, and he would be breathing so shallow, it scared me, you know? And I'd try to wake him up, and he wouldn't wake up. He would just, you know?
How'd you find out that he confessed?
What do you mean, confessed?
Well, he confessed to being an accessory, basically. Well, being with you at the time of the murder.
I had no clue about this until I was in the county jail.
The cops tell you?
No. Nobody told. I want to say my dad is the first one that told me. I had called home from the jail. You know, when I got locked up, it was like, Bill Odell was like, I'll tell you when the time is right. Then next thing I know, they're telling me this story about Josh. When I found out what he said, I was pissed. I mean, I'll be honest. I was pissed. I was like, what? Why is he lying? Why did he make this up? And then they told me about Stanley Sutton and the Shiflets and all this. And then I was like, yeah, you know, they probably threatened him.
Getting your mailing and shipping done can seem like a no-win situation. Going to the post office takes up valuable time, and leasing a postage meter is expensive, with multi-year commitments and hidden fees. Luckily, I know a better way. Stamps.com. With Stamps.com, you can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package right from your desk using your own computer and printer. You can even get special postage discounts you can't find at the post office. Plus, Stamps.com is more powerful than a postage meter at just a fraction of the cost. You can save at least 50% compared to a postage meter, and you'll avoid those time-consuming trips to the post office. I can say that I'm currently working on several cases in multiple jurisdictions, and it's so invaluable to save the time by using Stamps.com as opposed to waiting in long lines at the post office. Right now, you can go to Stamps.com and use my promo code UNDISCLOSED for this special offer. It's a 4-week trial plus a $110 bonus offer, including postage and a digital scale. So don't wait. Go to Stamps.com before you do anything else. Click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in UNDISCLOSED. That's Stamps.com. Enter UNDISCLOSED. So, how did Josh end up in that motel room in Richmond, Virginia, telling the Floyd County police that he'd been with Joey and Mark when they killed Isaac? It all started with a phone call. One night in August, Josh Flemister called Samantha Dawkins and Breanne Scarber. Later, Josh told Joey's attorney that because Samantha, who is Isaac's sister, was still blaming Joey for Isaac's death, he'd gotten the idea to call her and tell her, hey, there's no way Joey could have done this, because he was with me that night. At Joey's trial, Josh testifies that sometime after this conversation, he'd told Joey about what he'd said to Samantha and how Joey had told him that was a pretty stupid thing to do. During this phone call, Josh also took the opportunity to tell Samantha that he wanted to go out with her, but based on a second conversation between Josh and Samantha that took place the following evening, that doesn't seem to have gone over too well with Samantha. According to Sutton's testimony at Joey and Mark's preliminary hearing, Samantha came to him the next day and told him about Josh saying he'd been with Joey when they passed Isaac's wrecked truck on the way down to Cedartown. Sutton says, quote,
"And I told Samantha he was lying. He couldn't be. Because in the February interview that Joey Watkins had conducted with Mike Key, that he never implicated anybody with him when he went to Cedartown to see his girlfriend. So I instructed her to call him back and to do a taped interview. And she, in fact, did so."
So then, following Sutton's instructions, Samantha called Josh back the next night. "Hey," she says, "I'm sorry about what I said the other night. I hope you didn't take it too personally. It's just you caught me off guard. You're a good guy," she tells Josh, and she says that she would go out with him, but dealing with her brother's murder had understandably given her some trust issues she was still just trying to deal with. Josh tells her in response that he understands, and when Samantha asks if he'll let her ask him some questions, he agrees.
Samantha's recording of her phone conversation with Josh isn't the best quality, so apologies in advance. But it's important still because you can hear in this conversation the origins of the story that Josh would later tell police.
"I don't know. Like, I have some things I want to ask you and get off my mind. What happened with you saying that you were with him that night?"
"Yeah, I was with him down in Cedartown."
"But you said you were also with him when y'all came up, like, on the cops and everything, and he got scared and called Tandy."
"Because he saw his truck and he wanted Tandy to call you before he heard
him." "Oh, so you were with him when he called Tandy and everything?"
"Yeah."
"Oh. Did you go up with him to Cedartown to see Aslan?"
"Yeah."
"Was he just, were y'all just over there visiting with her family?"
"Yeah, we hung out, man."
"Well, I hear good things about Aslan's family. I hear they're really sweet people. So you went with him to Cedartown and back from Cedartown?"
"Yeah."
"Huh, I didn't know that."
"We've been doing something together all day."
"Y'all went to Atlanta that night, and then y'all came and visited Aslan that day?"
I don't know exactly what we did that night, because it's around the time I moved back from Atlanta."
This is all nonsense, though. Joey hadn't been in Atlanta with Josh that day. He'd been in Alabama with his uncle. And Josh hadn't been with Joey when he went to Cedartown. Josh and Joey could not have had dinner with Aslan's family because the Hoags all say the same thing. Aslan was sick in bed, so Joey came and sat with her in her bedroom and watched TV for a couple of hours before he went home. And Samantha herself brings up an obvious point. If Josh had been with Joey and could be his alibi for the murder, why in the world hadn't he said something back when the cops were investigating him?
"Well, why in the world... when Joey was being investigated, how come you didn't say, hey, yeah, I was with him, to clear his name?"
"I wasn't getting brought into it."
"Why? Were you scared because of, like, your previous crap that you were going to get, like, dogs for it?"
I've had my trouble with the law. My name. No, my name ain't too clear.
Yeah.
Anything I say, it, you know, would be believed."
"You think?"
"Not with me and Joey together."
"Honestly, if I were in your shoes, I wouldn't hang out with an accused murderer either. You know, I mean, no offense, but I wouldn't. But then again, I don't understand, because I'll go ahead and tell you, if that was my good friend, if that was Breanne being brought up for anything, and I was with her, and I knew she didn't do something, I'd be like, Breanne, I love you, girl, and I'm going to stand up for you, and I will be at your side and defend you and tell them I was with you, and I know you didn't do it."
"Yeah, but my story is really different.
Let him go down by himself? That's rough. Not really. I mean, you know I wouldn't.
I let him go down by himself. Or if it ain't none of my business."
I know Josh is hard to hear in this clip, but he's pretty vague anyway. He just tells Samantha that he didn't want to get involved. And besides, no one would believe anything he had to say. Anyway, it wasn't really any of his business. But Josh's answers verge on nonsensical for much of the conversation. Like when Samantha asked him about something he'd said the night before, about seeing Paul's little black Camaro in the woods near Isaac's wreck. or hearing that Paul's Camaro was seen there that night, something along those lines. Josh says no, it hadn't been Paul's Camaro there the night Isaac was shot. It was actually Chad Redden's truck that had been seen. But last night, he hadn't wanted to bring that up in front of Brianne because she was dating Chad, so he'd made up a claim that it had been Paul instead. Of course, Paul had been dating Samantha around the time of Isaac's murder, so that's kind of still a strange claim to bring up. Finally, when Samantha keeps pressing for information, Josh insists he doesn't have anything to tell her. Neither Joey nor Paul would tell him much about the case, Josh said, because both were being named as suspects in Isaac's murder.
I don't know when Joey's name was brought up and all that crap. I have no clue. Did he say anything to you about it?
He never talked about that much.
He never said a word about being mad or pissed off at anybody?
I mean, he couldn't talk with me about it because he was under investigation.
Well, he's not anymore.
No. Oh, no, we don't talk about it now anyway.
Why do you think that is? Have y'all even brought it to light? How does he feel when he sees those big billboards up about Isaac and flyers everywhere?
He don't say nothing to me.
You don't notice anything strange in his voice or anything?
I mean, I don't, not really, because I've hung out with Paul here and there.
Yeah.
And Paul's the same way as Joey is. But, you know, Paul was under investigation too.
Yeah.
Ever since that, neither one of them really talked to me about anything.
But Josh assured Samantha, if he ever does learn anything, he'll tell her. She deserves to know the truth, and he'd never cover up for someone for something that serious.
You know, if you ever did hear something, and you ever did know something, I'm sure there's protections and things I could do. You know that, don't you?
I mean, if you ever told me anything, if I ever found anything, I wouldn't be worried about protection. I'd go straight to the police. I mean, I wouldn't have no second thoughts about it. I mean, people can call me a narc or rat, whatever, but for what was done, I don't care what anybody says. They deserve, you know, y'all deserve justice.
Well, straight up, can I be honest? I still think Joey did it.
I mean, that's I'm not going to sit here and defend him. I mean, that ain't.
Did Joey walk and shoot my brother?
I mean, I don't know. He never stood up to
me. You know, I don't know either. But I guarantee you one thing. God says, surely, surely, all your sins will find you out. And you know what? Might as well sooner than later. It's gonna happen. And that's the way it is.
He did do it. I bought him out. I bought him out. I don't hang around with.
1 year later, at Joey's trial, Josh will testify he hadn't meant any harm by this call. He just thought that if Samantha heard that Josh had been with Joey that night, she'd stop pointing the finger at him.
Did you tell her that you and Joey were together that evening?
Yes, I did.
Did you also tell her that you called and told her that because Joey wanted you to?
Yes, I did.
Why'd you do that?
Because I really didn't want everybody to be mad at Joey. I mean, I didn't know what had really happened.
Whatever Josh's intentions were, his phone call with Samantha that night will kick off a series of events that would end up leading to Joey's conviction for Isaac's murder.
Thereafter, in late September, the Rome Police Department and Floyd County Police Department geared up for a major push in Joey's case. They put together a list of dozens of witnesses to re-interview. One of the names on the list is Josh Flemister, and next to his name, Sutton wrote, "He knows." He also lied to Samantha Dawkins about being with Joey going to Cedartown. On October 3rd, Josh was picked up and brought to the police station for an interview. He acknowledged he had lied about being with Joey on the night Isaac was shot, but he tells the Floyd County police officers that the lie had been Joey's idea. He says he'd been with Joey briefly on January 11th when Joey stopped by his house at about noon. Then that evening, sometime between 9 and 11 p.m., according to Josh, Joey called him. Joey had just seen Isaac's truck wrecked in the woods, he told Josh, and he'd called his sister to let her know to call Samantha about it. Joss told the police that the reason Joey had called him was to ask for a favor.
And when he called you, what did Joey tell you?
He wanted me to say that I was with him all day, and that we were either, first of all, we were on our way back from Atlanta, and then he changed it and said that we were on our way back from Cedartown.
He changed it during that conversation?
Yeah.
And what did he tell you to say exactly?
That I was with him and we were on our way back from Cedartown from his girlfriend's house.
Joss agreed to take part in the alibi because Joey was his friend, but he'd never asked any more questions about it. That's all he knows about Isaac's murder, he insists. But even though Joss couldn't help the police when it comes to explaining how Isaac was shot, Joss had lots of other things to say about Joey. Like how Joey's main goal in life every day was to try and find Isaac. And that when Joey left his house on January 11th, he told Joss that his purpose had been to go find Isaac.
And Joey came by your house 12 o'clock the day of the shooting and saying... Did he say that day he was going to find Isaac?
Yeah. Every day, Joey. That was Joey's main goal.
So you're saying when he left the house, it was to find Isaac?
Yeah.
And that Joey had killed Isaac's dog.
Why did Joey and what did he tell you about shooting of Isaac's dog?
He just told me that he killed the dog. He never told me how and he never spoke of it again. He told me that he killed the dog.
He said when he did it?
Just to get even.
For what?
For Isaac stealing Joey's girlfriend.
Actually, Isaac didn't steal her, but she already got rid of him.
She went with him.
And that Joey had lied to the police about going to Alabama. In fact, Joey didn't even like fishing, so that couldn't be true.
Okay, Joey has told the police that he, in fact, on January the 11th, had been fishing all day. Is this the truth?
No.
And you're sure of that?
No, because he stopped at my house by lunch.
And do you know if Joey ever fishing a little trip to the creek for 10 minutes on a four-wheeler?
No.
If Joey said he was fishing all day, would you take that as the truth?
No, because Joey's not a fisherman.
But all this was stuff the cops had already known, stuff they'd already been told by other witnesses or had learned from their investigation. So things stalled out for a bit. At some point, Joss left town and ended up working on a site up near Richmond, Virginia.
And then on November 8th, Stanley Sutton got a call. It was Paul Allen, Joey's former friend and a former suspect in Isaac's murder. Joss, Paul told him, had been confessing to others that he was with Joey when he shot Isaac.
I got a phone call from Lacey Lambert, and later on that night, she stopped by, and I rode her to her house. Later on that evening, I'd asked her if she'd heard from Joss Flemister, and that's when she began to tell me that he had moved to Virginia, because one night they were sitting around, and he kept telling her he was in big trouble, in real big trouble, and he ended up getting drunk that night and telling her that he was with Joey and Tim Hughes the night that they shot Isaac. And she said that's why Joss had moved to out of state to Virginia, to try to avoid it, I guess.
Lacey was 16 at the time. She dated Paul, and she knew both Joss and Joey, and they'd hung out a few times, including once on a night not long after Isaac's murder. And she told Paul, 10 months later in November, that's when Joss had told her about how he was with Joey and Tim Hughes, Tandy's boyfriend, when they'd killed Isaac. The next day, Floyd County brought Lacey in for an interview.
And me and Shayna and Joss Flemister, we were sitting in the living room, and he kept telling us that he was in a world of shit because he had done something, you know, he was accessory, but he wouldn't ever say nothing. And then finally he, like, got really drunk, and he told us everything that, you know, he told us that he was accessory to a murder, and he was with Joey when Joey killed Isaac, and he shot the window. He was trying to scare him. He shot the window, and then he shot again, and he hit him.
But Lacey says that after that one night, Joss never again said Joey had been involved, let alone that he'd been involved, or been there, or seen something, or knew anything about Joey doing this. Instead, from then on, Joss would always tell Lacey that he thought Paul had killed Isaac.
But every time we talked to Joss about it, he was blaming it on Paul.
Before he told y'all that he was involved?
No, after it. He was like, you know, Paul did it because Isaac wouldn't let Samantha date Paul anymore, so Paul did it.
Okay. Okay, I'm confused. Josh has told you already that him and he was with Joey Watkins and Tim.
Well, this is like in front of people, if we were ever in front of people and anybody ever said anything, it's like, I believe Paul did it, you know?
But he'd already told you he's an accessory, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Accessory to the murder. Mm-hmm.
I'm with Bill Shiflett. I'm confused too because, okay, so a couple days after Isaac's death, Josh is confessing to Lacey and Shayna, and then Lacey and Shayna tell absolutely no one about this except for Shayna's sister, Jana. And moreover, even aside from not telling anyone about this confession, they don't seem to find it weird at all that Josh then spends the next 10 months telling everyone that Paul had done the murder. But then one day, for no apparent reason, Lacey casually mentions to Paul that back in January, Josh said Joey had done it. And oh yeah, Josh was actually with Joey when he did the murder. And yet, Lacey apparently doesn't mention to Paul that Josh had also spent the rest of that year claiming Paul was the real killer. And then there's this. Lacey told the police that her friend Shayna Walker had also heard Josh's confession that night. She says that in her police statement, and she also says that at Joey's trial.
Now, that's the words he used, accessory to murder.
Yes, that's exactly.
And he said that in front of a Walker woman, too. Mm-hmm. Would she tell us the same thing that you told her?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Shayna.
Shayna.
But an hour after speaking to Lacey, the cops did go speak to Shayna. And Shayna did not tell Sutton and Shiflett the same thing Lacey had told them.
Joey and Josh were over at my house, and we were talking and everything, and they had asked if we had heard about Isaac, you know, that guy, if we knew him and if we had heard about him getting shot. So we talked about that for a little while, you know, that we didn't know him and, you know, how bad it was. And Joey left, and Josh stayed there, and Josh was drinking. He told us that if Joey got caught, that he could be charged with accessory to murder. And he told us that like three or four times. And I asked him if Joey did it, and he said no.
And that's it. According to Shayna, Josh and Joey did come over. Josh did get drunk. And at some point, Josh had told them that he was worried that if Joey got accused for Isaac's murder, he'd wind up getting charged as an accessory, on account of them being friends. But, Shayna tells the police, she naturally asked Josh what on earth he meant by that. Was Joey guilty? Had he done this? Why was he afraid? And Josh had told her no, Joey hadn't done it. He was just worried. Not because Joey was guilty or Joey had said anything, but he thought their friendship and that alone would make him a target. And then there's another strange thing about Lacey's interview I still can't figure out. When she talks to the cops on November 10th, she references, or seems to start to reference, an earlier discussion she'd had with cops.
We won't know if it's true or not that Josh told you that him and Joe and Tim Hughes were together and they saw Isaac and either turned around on him or just wanted to scare him and shot the window out, and then the other one shot him in the head.
Yeah, that's what I told you all last. Yeah.
And I really wish Lacey had finished her sentence. That's what I told y'all last what? Last night? Last time? Whatever it was, there shouldn't have been a last night or last time or last anything, because this interview is supposed to be Lacey's first time speaking to the cops. But from the way Lacey is talking in that interview, it doesn't sound like it was the first time. And she also seems to confirm that, yes, she'd said it was Tim Hughes that Josh had identified as the third person involved in the murder. So yeah, even aside from the fact that Lacey and Shayna can't agree on whether Josh actually confessed or whether Josh was just expressing concern that he might get roped into something if Joey did, that's the other problem with Lacey's statement. Lacey is saying that the third person in the murder is Tandy's boyfriend, Tim Hughes, who at one time the police did suspect because Tim and Joey had been together on the 12th, the day after Isaac was shot, when they went to Alabama to fish again with Joey's uncle. But by November of 2000, the cops were no longer really interested in Tim. It was Mark Free they wanted to charge. They had a bunch of Mark's cellmates that were sitting there ready to testify that Mark had confessed to them. And since that was kind of the biggest deal in the state's case at that point, aside from, well, Corey Jacobs, they couldn't really lose that evidence, which means Mark had to be the third person, not Tim.
Time to check in now with one of our most delicious sponsors, Blue Apron. Now, Blue Apron only has one mission, and that's to make incredible home cooking accessible to everybody. So whether you have never stepped a foot in the kitchen, have no idea what to do with a pot or a pan, or you're like me, you've been cooking for years but still end up getting takeout 3 or 4 times a week, because you know what? It takes time to go to the grocery store, get the ingredients you need, find the recipe, and put it all together. Blue Apron will work for you. And that's because for less than $10 per meal per person, Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with ingredients that are already portioned out right to your front door, fresh every week, so you can make delicious home-cooked meals in a snap. Blue Apron knows that when you cook with incredible ingredients, and by the way, all ingredients are not created equal, you end up making incredible meals. And Blue Apron only delivers the best ingredients because they have established partnerships with over 150 farms, fisheries, and ranchers across the states. They get seafood that's sourced sustainably. The beef, chicken, and pork comes from responsibly raised animals, and the produce comes from regenerative farming practices. And they take these fantastic ingredients and turn them into seasonal, delicious, diverse recipes from all around the world. For example, a few of the many offerings they have this month in October are crispy chicken Milanese with warm Brussels sprouts, celery and potato salad, roast pork steam buns with black garlic mayonnaise and spicy cabbage slaw, and heck, I don't even eat pork, but that sounds delicious, and Thai green curry chicken and squash with yu choy, jasmine rice, and cashews. You get to decide what meals you want to come to your door each week, and you know what? You don't even have to get the deliveries each week. It's totally customizable and flexible. So do yourself a favor and check out this week's menu and get your first 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/UP. Again, that's blueapron.com/UP. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. Undeterred by these factual discrepancies, our intrepid investigators set out the next day on a road trip. Their destination, a suburb of Richmond, Virginia, where they will stake out Josh Flemister at his work site, where he was tiling the floor of a Bojangles. Once work was done for the day, Josh and two of his co-workers, guys from Rome that Josh only knew as Kojak and Mickey, went back to their motel room at the Best Western. They'd just opened up a case of beer when Sutton and the Shiflets stormed in the unlocked door and asked Josh to come with them. The Floyd County officers took Josh to their motel room across the street and questioned him about Isaac's murder. Before long, Josh began to confess. Yes, he had been with Joey the night of the murder. He'd been with Mark Free, too. They'd gone out driving around, and when they saw Isaac's truck, Joey went crazy and just started shooting.
About where were you when you first saw Isaac?
Right there at that store, that new store.
That's across Floyd Junior College, or and close to it?
Down to this dirt, right the one, right to the red light beside the motel.
Okay, and when you saw, where were you?
Riding.
Riding, which way were you going?
Coming, going towards the house.
Coming back toward Rome?
Yeah.
And when you saw Isaac Dawkins, what did Joey say?
That's Isaac Dawkins.
And then what did he do?
Went crazy.
And in shooting. What way?
Started shooting.
Did he chase him a ways?
Yeah.
How far did he chase him?
A mile, mile and a half, half a mile.
How many times did he shoot at him?
Twice.
And in all this time, was you telling him to stop or asking him what he was doing?
Yeah. I mean, I was freaking out. I mean, I didn't know what was going on.
And what did Free say?
It was just, he didn't say much, he was doing the same thing.
For some of the details, Josh was a little vague. But for other things, he was able to tell the Floyd County Police exactly what had happened. He could tell them, for instance, that Joey had picked him up at his house sometime around 4 or 5 p.m. that day, and about the precise routes Joey had driven to pick up Mark Free, and later the route he'd driven to drop off Josh. And he could describe for them what had happened in the moments before and after Isaac was shot.
Did you see any damage being done when he shot?
I saw the truck go off the road.
Did you ever see a windshield, a back window break?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, think hard, because I believe you did. You may not remember it, but I believe you did.
I mean, my eyes really, I was looking at Joe and I was looking at Mark. I mean, I really wasn't focused on what was happening.
Okay. After you got on down the road, shots were fired. And how many shots do you say was fired?
Two. From one.
And you got on down the road, the shots were fired, and what did Isaac Dawkins' truck do?
It went straight for like a minute, not even a minute, but then it just started curving off to the right.
And which way did it go from there?
Into the woods.
Did it go across the median?
No.
Huh?
It's on the right side of the road.
It's what?
Ain't on the right side of the road.
Where did you see it go?
To the right into the woods.
You didn't see it cross back over and go to the left?
Mm-hmm.
And according to Josh, after dropping him off at home, Joey told Josh two different alibis they were supposed to use. Only they weren't going to be used right away. Josh shouldn't say anything about being with Joey quite yet. The plan was for Joey to go around telling everyone, including the police, he was alone the night Isaac died. But then months later in August, Joey instructed Josh to go tell Isaac's sister that, actually, Josh had been with him that night.
What did Joey say to you when you got home?
Nothing. I mean, just say that we were, at first, that we were in Atlanta at a club, and the second, that we were on our, that he was on his way back from Cedartown.
And he told you those two alibis on the way to your house?
Yeah.
Instead of the next day like you tried to tell me?
Yeah.
So y'all, he did discuss his alibi?
I mean, he came up with two different ones.
On the way to the house?
Yeah, about the time we hit the neighborhood.
All right. Then when did he decide for you to tell Samantha Dawkins?
About 2 months later.
That was 2 months later, so he could...
Well, I mean, I don't know for sure. It's a month and a half to 2 months.
So he could start talking with her again.
And as Sutton was careful to get on the record, everything Josh was saying was said voluntarily, without a hint of coercion or duress.
Is this the truth?
Yes.
You're not lying?
No.
You're not making any of this up?
No.
This, you will put your hands on the Bible and swear on the oath that this is the truth?
Yes.
And you're not doing this under any kind of duress?
No.
They've been kind and cordial to you, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Has myself or anybody else in this room at any time ever threatened you in any way, bodily harm or anything?
No.
No. You wouldn't stand for it anyway, would you?
No.
End of statement. Josh Flemster, approximately 8 o'clock.
And then they were done. Sutton told him he was free to go. Josh wasn't too sure how long the interview lasted. He just wanted to get out of there, and finally the cops let him leave. He said he knew he'd been gone for a pretty good while, though, because by the time he got back across the street to the motel room at the Best Western, half of the case of beer was already gone. Josh was so stressed about his encounter with the Floyd officers that he told Kojak and Mickey what he'd done. They told him telling the cops that made-up story had been a terrible idea. He could end up in jail for saying things like that.
The next day, the Floyd County officers made the trek back to Rome, and the morning after that, they met with Prosecutor Tammy Colston. It was agreed at this point that they now had probable cause to move forward against Mark and Joey, so arrest warrants were drawn up and executed that afternoon.
At the preliminary hearing in December, Sutton testified that Josh's statements had been the probable cause they needed to arrest Joey and Mark. And this came as a shock for Joey and Mark themselves, as well as their attorneys, because before that, no one had a clue that Josh had any relevance to this case. A few weeks later, Bill O'Dell, attorney for the defense, was able to track Josh down and record an interview. Question number one for Josh: what in the fresh hell had happened?
Sutton's latest, let me just tell you what he's saying. His latest is that you have given, I don't know if it's a tape statement or a written statement, about actually being in the vehicle with them concerning that. Why in the world would you give them a statement like that?
They came all the way to Virginia. I was working out of town, and they kept harassing me. I mean, they come all the way
to Virginia. They being who?
Bill.
Shiflett.
Tommy, and Sutton.
Okay.
They all come to Virginia and kept harassing me. I mean, I'm all the way down there working. They harassed me in Rome. I got a job traveling, so I left town. Well, they come all the way down there and found me and watched us work and everything. And when they came to us, I mean, I ain't gonna lie about it, I was pretty messed up.
I've heard you had a little bit of a problem with
drugs and alcohol.
And are you getting any help for that?
No.
Okay.
They kept telling me, tell us what we want to hear and we'll let you go. Or if not, when you get back to town, you're going to be in jail too. They kept telling me, tell us what we want to hear. I was like, I don't know what you want to hear. I don't know anything about it. So, I mean, I started making up a bunch of lies and stuff. And then when I got back to town, the day I got back, I called them. Because they wanted a district attorney to meet with me. I was like, no, there ain't no need in bringing her. They come to my grandparents' house, and I told them straight up. I sat there and told them I lied about everything.
Josh said the Floyd County officers hadn't told him what to say. They hadn't given him a statement to make or anything like that. In fact, what he'd said had been up to him. Because Sutton had been talking to the Shiflets in his presence, though, he was able to pick up the factual details that he needed to flesh out a convincing story.
I don't know, I just said that depending on what I told him would depend on whether or not when I got back in town, if a warrant would be served for my arrest or not.
Did they ask you to put yourself in the vehicle?
Pretty much.
So they sort of suggested to you the story?
Yeah, see, I didn't know nothing about the gun. I didn't know nothing about Mark. They told me that they had a 9mm. That's where I got that from.
They had a 9mm, or they knew it was done by 9mm?
They said that they knew that Mark had a 9mm, or whoever was in the car had a 9mm. That's where I got the gun from.
Okay.
Now, importantly, Josh said that he never meant to harm Joey or Mark. Sutton and the Shiflets, in fact, had even promised him that whatever happened to Joey wouldn't be because of him. Josh's future, though, would depend on what statements he made to them that day. On the other hand, Joey's wouldn't. And besides, according to them, Mark had already confessed to the murder, so nothing that Josh said about Mark could actually hurt Mark more.
The problem is they use that, your statement, to get probable cause to get it found over. And
so they told me no matter what I said, it wouldn't be because of me.
Exactly. Did they tell you that they had confession, that Mark had confessed to other people?
In jail.
In jail?
Yeah.
Even in his January interview, though, Josh continued to point the finger at Paul, seemingly with no factual basis.
When was Paul a suspect?
From the beginning, at the beginning, because he was, like, dating Samantha.
Did Shiflet tell you that?
No, I knew that. Paul said that he was a suspect, and I ran into Paul this weekend. And he said that his lawyer told him that he should be prepared to go to jail Tuesday.
For what?
I have no clue.
Paul in trouble for something?
I haven't talked to Paul.
Tuesday, the other day?
Yeah, yesterday. See, I don't know if they know this, and I don't know if this matters, but around the same time, and I'm not trying to bring Paul into this, but Paul tried to sell his car a couple of days before that happened, the Camaro. And then that's all that was ever said about that.
So even if Josh was able to pick up key facts from the detectives themselves, the cops weren't actually instructing him on what to say. Josh's confession instead was a creature of his own making. So sure, the cops inadvertently, well, maybe inadvertently, had spotted him a few facts to help his narrative along, but the bulk of what Josh confessed to came from his own head. Now, on the one hand, you might ask, doesn't it seem unlikely that he could have come up with a story that fit the facts that closely unless he actually knew something about the truth of what happened with Isaac's death? Well, the answer is no, because Josh's story may have fit the rough outline of what was known about Isaac's murder, but Josh's understanding of some of the case's key uncontroverted facts was simply wrong. And despite the Floyd County officers' near frantic attempts to steer Josh back on track, Josh's mistakes showed that he really didn't have any knowledge whatsoever about the crime at hand.
See, when I told them what I, you know, made up, they told me that there was no possible way, because I told them what, you know, I thought was on the side of the road the truck was on. They told me there's no possible way because the truck swerved to the other side of the road. They told me that.
Oh, so you didn't even tell them the right story.
Mm-mm.
And that was the first time they interviewed you?
No, that was in Virginia.
Yeah, I mean, when they came up there and you told them that
they
you were in
me,
that.
Yeah, they told me that there's no possible way because I, like, picked the wrong side of the road. They told me that the truck swerved across to the other side, that there's no way.
So when you told them the story, they knew your story wasn't true?
Yeah, I think that's why Sutton kept asking me, is this the truth? Is this the truth?
Okay.
The problems with Josh's story go well beyond his inability to correctly identify or describe even the most basic factual elements of how the wreck happened. I mean, clearly from Josh's statements up in Virginia, he didn't really know which way Isaac's truck had gone after the wreck. He kept saying it went right, which would have put it on the northbound side. But everyone who was at the scene and everyone who would have seen the wreck knew that the car had crossed from the northbound lane into the southbound lane before rolling over in a ditch, something that understandably, didn't seem very likely to Josh and wasn't part of his story. But there are other problems too. Like, for instance, even though Josh had been able to identify one of the weapons as a 9mm, and had also heard from rumors around the town that a 22 had also been involved, Josh thought it had been a 22 rifle, not a 22 pistol. Apparently, Josh hadn't considered the fact that there's no way Joey could have been driving a truck and firing a rifle at the same time.
Did you see Joey with a gun?
Yes, according to
Jake. Told the detectives that it was a 22? Okay. Handgun or rifle? Yes or no?
Yes, sir.
Handgun?
I thought I told him a rifle, but I guess it was a handgun.
And Josh has no knowledge of all the phone calls that Joey was definitely making in the moments before, during, and after the murder. He doesn't mention, for instance, sitting in awkward silence for 5 minutes while Joey was on the phone with Aslan. And he doesn't mention Joey making a string of calls after the murder to his grandmother, his uncle, his home. Josh also makes the same mistake as Corey Jacobs and David Jones. He claims that Joey dropped him off at his house after the murder, something that can't be reconciled with Joey's known timeline, and him showing up in Cedartown a short time after. Nevertheless, when Josh got back to Rome and recanted everything he'd said in Virginia, the Floyd County officer strongly encouraged him to stick with his earlier story, to stand by what he'd told them in the motel room.
I'm sure they told you, you know, as long as you tell that story, they're not going to have you prosecuted.
Mm-hmm.
They told you that? I said yes.
They told me I should stick to my story.
Okay.
And when I go to court, that's what I should say. And even after I told them,
even after you told them
that I lied, they told me when I go to court, I should stick with what I've said.
Okay.
Otherwise, something will be brought up on me.
Appreciate that.
But Josh's impossible story isn't the only proof that his confession had been false. Josh actually had an alibi, too. Pretty strong evidence that he hadn't been with Joey that night, that he'd been at home when the shooting occurred.
See, I've got my phone records show where I hit star 69 at 7:45 and 7:15.
At 7:15? At home?
Yep.
Can you get me a copy of that?
Yep.
Okay. Did you tell Sutton that?
Yep. They never even asked to see him. My dad, because when they called
you,
my
told
house,
Sutton you were at your house.
Yeah. When I got back into Virginia.
Okay.
Because my dad went searching, called the phone company, got all the phone records because he knew I had a problem with hitting star 69. He's the one that last person calls and I have car ID.
The phone records back Josh up. At 7:15 p.m., Josh's phone had been used to dial star 69. There's no way to prove for a fact that it was Josh holding the phone, but we have his dad saying it was a long-standing point of contention between them that Josh kept adding charges to the phone bill by dialing star 69, something no one else in the household did. So, combined with the strange and possible story Josh was telling and the phone records that matched his actual claim of where he was that night, which was work at Red Lobster followed by home, there's no reason to think that Josh actually had any involvement whatsoever in Isaac's death.
Here at Undisclosed, one of our favorite new shows this season is Conviction. What makes this show different is that it starts where most stories end, and that's behind bars. Longtime listeners of Undisclosed will know this, but each year in America, over 10,000 people are wrongfully convicted. They end up behind bars because of forensic errors, evidence tampering, and all kinds of crazy reasons. The show Conviction takes that on because it draws its material from real-life wrongful conviction units across the country. These units are called Conviction Integrity Units, and their whole purpose is to review potentially wrongful verdicts, to investigate those verdicts, and then recommend that the sentence be overturned or let stand. What makes the drama in Conviction so intense is that the Conviction Integrity Unit on the show only has 5 days to do all this. The CIU team, made up of lawyers, a former detective, and forensic experts, is led by Hayes Morrison. She's an ex-president's daughter and reform party girl, who now stands as a defender for the unjustly prosecuted. She ain't afraid to raise a little hell, and is known not only for her feisty attitude, but also her willingness to question every part of the judicial system. So this week's Torn from the Headlines episode of Conviction finds the Conviction Integrity Unit investigating the case of a mother who was convicted for murdering her autistic son. But Hayes Morrison suspects reasonable doubt and that the system worked against this seemingly caring mother. What secret is this family hiding? Or is this mother really guilty of this heinous homicide? It's a case that's going to have you guessing and second guessing right up until the very last minute of the episode. So check it out from the executive producer of Criminal Minds. Conviction airs Monday at 10, 9 Central, right after Dancing with the Stars, only on ABC.
Lacey Lambert actually pops up in the case file one more time in a second tape-recorded statement she gave to the police in January. She'd called up Sutton to tell him she'd actually heard from Josh again, and he was incriminating himself once again. But this time, inadvertently, she was actually corroborating what Josh would testify to at trial. Because when the Floyd County officers had come to Virginia to interrogate Josh, prior to turning on the tape recorder to take his statement, Sutton and the Shiflets had played bits and pieces of Lacey and Shayna's interviews for him, and told him that people were saying he'd confessed. They didn't tell him who was saying that, but Josh had recognized Lacey's voice. And after he got back to Rome, he gave Lacey a call. Afterwards, Lacey went back to Sutton and recounted their conversation.
When he called and told you that he wasn't mad at you, why did he say he wasn't mad at you? Is it because you talked to the police about what he told you?
Yeah, because he told me, he said, I was like, you knew it was me and Shana, right? He said, yeah. He said, they didn't tell me your name. He said, but I knew that it was y'all's voice. He said, and I just didn't know exactly why you did that.
Okay.
And he told me, he said, I really don't have any problems with anybody. He said, but when I see Joey out, me and Joey's got a problem. And when I see Paul out, me and Paul's got a problem. Whatever that's supposed to mean.
Okay, in the phone conversation, prior to going on tape, Bill Schiffer and I was asking a few questions about the conversation that you had with Josh. You had told us prior to going on tape that later on in the conversation, he told you he told the police the truth.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Well, how did he say that?
He was telling me about how he, how y'all came up there and talked to him, and he didn't tell y'all the truth. You know, he just told y'all that, you know, so y'all would leave him alone. Mm-hmm. And then right after that, I told him, I said, Josh, if you know anything, I said, you need to go up there and talk to him. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, I did, Lacey, you know, I did. He said, and I told him everything that I knew.
Of course, Sutton interpreted Lacey's statement to mean Josh had confirmed to Lacey that his confession was the truth. But that's not what Lacey actually describes in the tape.
And he's like, at first, he's like, they were harassing me so much. He said, I just told them what they wanted to hear, so they'd leave me alone. He said, but then when I came back home, he said, I went up there and he said, I told them, you know, he said, I told them everything that I knew.
But what Josh told the police and the DA after returning to Rome was that he hadn't known anything, that he'd made it all up. If the statement he made after getting back to Rome was a true statement, then Lacey was unknowingly corroborating what Josh had been telling Joey's defense attorneys. That his statement in Virginia to the cops hadn't been true. It was something he made up completely to get the cops off his back. But then when he got back to Rome, he told the truth and recanted.
Josh testified at both Mark's and Joey's trials. He said that Joey had never told him anything to suggest he'd been involved in Isaac's murder, had never told him that he'd killed Isaac's dog, had never asked him to provide an alibi. He'd made all those things up. At trial, Prosecutor Tammy Colston told the jury that Josh's confession was a false one. Well, at least at times she did. During parts of her case, she would imply that Josh had been there, but in closing, faced with the factual impossibility of Josh's guilt, she acknowledged that Josh had made it all up. But, she said, that's actually just more proof of Joey's guilt. According to Colston,
that is what Josh Flemister did. He promised Joey Watkins he would help him out and get him an alibi and say he went to Cedartown with him. And the lie kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. But Josh Flemister in his statements remembers some things he said, two shots fired, shot from the back, several things that he knew about this killing of Isaac Dawkins that he would not have known but for either being there or Joey Watkins telling him. We know he wasn't there, because he even told the wrong side of the road. It didn't even go off on the correct side of the road, so we know Josh wasn't there. How did he know these things, I ask you? How did he know those things?
So, yeah, Josh falsely confessed, Colston agreed. But he knew these things about the case that he couldn't have known on his own, and therefore Joey must have told them, and therefore Joey had knowledge of the murder that he'd only have if he was the killer. But what I still don't understand is how Tammy Coulson could have been so unfazed by the fact that her investigators could so easily have extracted a false confession from a witness in an almost effortless fashion. Sutton, Bill Shiflett, Tommy Shiflett, they've proven that they could scare a witness enough that he'd implicate himself in a murder just to make them go away. That's not in dispute here. Tammy Coulson agrees. Josh made it up. He falsely confessed, faced with interrogation in Virginia. So, shouldn't it have concerned her that maybe some of the other witnesses in the case, maybe some of their statements that were obtained by Sutton and the Shiflets, that maybe those have been coerced too? Apparently not. According to Tammy Coulson, the false confession has nothing to say about what Floyd County was doing or how they're investigating. All it says is that, you know, Joey gave Josh enough knowledge of the case where he could falsely confess. So even though the jury heard Tammy Coulson say, though, that we know Josh wasn't there, they also heard her repeatedly refer to the evidence in a way that implied Josh had been there. And at the end of the day, that's the takeaway that many of the jurors got. Several of the jurors I spoke to had specific memories about how this whole murder was done with three boys in the car that night, which means the state got things both ways. It had Josh, its testifying accomplice, but it also had him as not an accomplice, not someone charged, not someone facing charges himself. So, much more credible because of that. Josh was for sure a handy tool for the prosecution. He got them probable cause to arrest Joey and Mark. He bolstered their claims that Joey and Mark had been confessing to everyone, and he provided, via his recorded statement, eyewitness details about how the shooting went down. But the state also knew Josh had been lying, that most of what he said was nonsense, and the rest he'd borrowed from rumor on the street and what the cops had been saying in his presence. Somehow, though, Stanley Sutton and the Shiflets and Tammy Coulson all managed to convince themselves that even though Josh was lying about being an eyewitness to these events, the things he'd claimed to have seen were still true. It's just Josh hadn't seen them himself.
I think when Josh confessed in their minds, that was like, we don't know what actually happened. We don't know the details. Something's really wrong here, but this is proof he actually did it somehow or another.
When Josh went to Virginia or wherever he went, I guess they took that as he wants to get away from all this or whatever, whatnot. I don't know. But when they ran up there to see him or whatever, they already knew what kind of person Josh was. He was scared to death of getting locked up, and I think they went up there and they manipulated him. He was probably drunk and on pills, and they probably scared the piss out of him, and you know, this is what you're gonna say, this is what you know, because later on he said they told him what to say before they turned the recorders on. And Josh was scared enough to where he said what they wanted to hear. And then when Josh got back home and you know, he realized, I just screwed up for somebody that really, you know, somebody that really cared about me. I just screwed up, because I did. I tried to help Josh. I tried to get him back on track. Josh was a wreck. He was a mess. My mom and dad tried to help him.
If things had played out a bit differently, he could be locked up beside you right now.
Yeah, I know. I was mad at, I hated Josh for a long time for this, but because I think he's the reason that they helped. He's the whole reason they got an arrest warrant on me, I think.
Yeah.
I hated him a long time for that, you know, but over the past couple of years, you know, I've learned I've got to get over that. Things happen, you know. And I realized the situation from being around these guys in here, I realized how he was and how really sick he was as far as the alcohol and the pills and all that. And I you know, I forgive him.
Earlier this week, you might have heard that there was a new filing in Adnan's case. So next week, we're going to take a small break from Joey's case to bring you a special episode all about the motion to get Adnan Syed out of prison on bail. Next time on Undisclosed.
Wraps up the 15th episode of the second season of Undisclosed. Folks, we are rolling right into the credits, so let's get to it. Thanks, as always, to the hardworking folks down at the Georgia Innocence Project. Listeners, you're heeding the call. Make sure you send a little love down to the Georgia Innocence Project at their website, georgiainnocenceproject.org. You can donate right on the homepage. You should do so. Every little dollar counts, and they're operating on a shoestring budget. Our sponsors this week ensure that we are able to bring the show to you. Let's thank them. Stamps.com, you're wonderful. You stick with us. We appreciate it so much. ABC's newest drama, Conviction. Having a lot of fun watching this show, so make sure you check it out. It's at 10 Eastern, 9 Central, only on ABC on Monday nights. And finally, our most delicious sponsor, Blue Apron. Corporate peoples at Blue Apron, if you're listening, thank you. You provided my lunch and dinner yesterday and today, so I'm very grateful for all the deliciousness. This show has producers, and you probably know who they are, but I'll name them anyway. Rebecca Lavoy of Partners in Crime Media and the two great podcasts, Crime Writers On and These Are Their Stories, produces this show. She gets help from the wonderful Hannah McCarthy and Brooke Giddings of the Actual Innocence podcast. Brooke has been making some real quality audio over there at Actual Innocence, so if you haven't already, give it a listen. Methel Telhan is the super producer. She keeps it all together behind the scenes. Thanks, Methel. We get website help from Christy Williams and Nina Musser. Thanks to you too. Baluki on our logo. Yo, Baluki, you ever gonna send another email or what? You're mysterious. Hey, folks, we do an addendum. It's on Thursdays, and it's hosted by John Cryer. So here's what you do. Listen to this episode, then tweet at Mr. Cryer your questions concerning this episode. You can do so using the hashtag UDAddendum on any of our social media accounts. Those include the Facebooks, the Twitters, and the Instagrams. Our handle is @UndisclosedPod. Tweet using that hashtag, and maybe, just maybe, we will read your question on the addendum. Been getting a lot of great content that Mr. Cryer has been taking care of in the addendum, so keep it coming. Lastly and leastly, your executive producer is Dennis Robinson, and he looks forward to seeing you next week for the 16th episode of Undisclosed Second Season. Until then,